Welcome to part two of our interview with Marcus Goodfellow of Metello Wines.
You know, and again, the point of this whole interview is to talk about this idea that winemakers are farmers. That's what it really comes down to. The families very commonly are, you know, they're farmer families because this is something that comes from the land. And it's you know, interesting to hear that you have this more diverse background, that you didn't grow up in the business per se, but you have the background of being a farmer. So you get that whole thing.
Yeah, Oregon is just really in the last, I'd say, 3 to 5 years, maybe, well, 5 to 7 now, time flies, really starting to move into second-generation winemaking families. Jason Lett took over Irie when his father passed away. David's certainly formative, I think, obviously, in some ways formed the industry in Oregon. Also, and nurtured, I think, some other minds who came in at close to when he did. Just to prove that it could go. Ben Castile at Bethel Heights is taking over the winemaking for Terry Castile there. And these are kids that you see the advantage that they have. I'm a little envious of the fact, you know, they've grown up with it the entire time. But I try to make up in enthusiasm what I lack in long-term practice.
You're bringing this up. It is a very good point because, of course, you're seeing that in California, which has this obviously longer history, or at least more obvious history, I'd say. But, this is where a big change is happening in the industry, is where older folks are moving on and the younger groups are coming in. And is there any kind of a major change, or do you feel that some of these younger winemakers are going, well, that's what my dad did, but this is what I'm going to do?
I think Oregon is really lucky that way. Yeah, both of these guys have imprinted themselves upon the winery, but both of them have done it in a way that really truly respects what was laid down by the previous generation. I think it helps, you know, you have two highly regarded winemakers that were ahead of them. David Lett, to me, is one of those people that I look at as an icon. My respect for David, really very, very few people had the commitment that he had. Not only the commitment to plant Pinot Noir in the Willamette Valley, the commitment to plant Pinot Gris for the first time in the United States, but also as the industry changed, as you saw people making these bigger, plusher style of wines, David never flinched. He never changed, and he never strayed away from the idea of that his belief that, you know, for Pinot Noir to age, it has to have tannin, it has to have extract, but that you shouldn't be trying to, you know, pull every little soft bit of fruit out of it that you can, that it needs to have nerve and balance. And I think that seeing as the plush wines became popular, his unwillingness to give in to that trend to me is something that was really, inspiring.
I think that's a thing you hear often, that there's a trend no different than there is standard farming practices. And then maybe guys like you come along who are younger and say, I'm going to do something different. I hear this story all the time. Well, I tried this and all the old guys laughed at me. And then when they tried my wine, they thought, oh, well, maybe he does have some good ideas.
There's certainly some of that, I think, I feel that our wines were one of the smaller, younger producers, but that there's a fairly high regard for what we're doing. And even among the older winemakers, particularly because of the fact that, again, and I take the inspiration from David, you know, I'm really committed to the style that we do, and that you know, for me, I worked in the restaurant industry for quite a few years. Wine is something that's meant to be with food, and I certainly view that while there is, I think it's not uncommon in the wine industry to see, you know, what I think of as sort of a rancher mentality. You're creating a prize bull. The approach that I try to bring to it is that we're more wildlife photographers. The idea is to go out and capture a moment, whatever that moment may be, and then bring that back. And then that's where the makeup, you know, you try to, whether you get the most fantastic moment on, you know, in wildlife photography ever, or if you're sitting out there and there's not much happening at all, you still have to figure out how to present that in its best possible light.
So talking about your winery specifically, how many cases are you guys making?
We're in a little bit of a growth pattern right now. In 2010, we made a little over 2,000, just barely. In 2011, we'll be about 3,000 cases.
Okay. And specifically, obviously, we've talked about Chardonnay and Pinot, which is what I believe you make. But are you making anything beyond that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what are they?
So the rule for the winery is that we don't work with anything that's been irrigated, and we don't work with anything that's not planted in the Northern Willamette Valley. That being said, I feel that Oregon is a growth state. It's very young, and so that we should explore the region. We make a little bit of Pinot Gris, which is obviously fairly well known. We do both a sort of a fresh style that's bottled 7 months after vintage and is more mineral-driven, very linear, very bright. And then we do a barrel-fermented version of the Pinot Gris as well, just to kind of show that Pinot Gris can be handled in a little bit more serious manner as well. We do a small amount of Chardonnay, which I'm really probably the most finicky about where we work with fruit is Chardonnay. Because Chardonnay, there's so much of it out there already, and the world doesn't need another Chardonnay unless it's going to be really good. We definitely Pinot Noir. And then, oddly enough, there's a gentleman who I'm not sure if he's simply crazier than David Lett was or if he wanted to you know, take the seat. He planted Viognier in 1994 and Syrah in 1995 in the valley. He's right outside of a little town called Yamhill. And in 2006, I tasted at a friend's winery who was working with – they have an acre of estate Syrah as well. And their wine sent me on a journey looking for more Syrah in the valley, and I found it at a vineyard called Duvert. So we do a very classic Northern Rhone style co-ferment of Syrah Viognier that's 100% whole cluster. There's no destemming. It's the traditional way that they did it in Cornas and Côte Rôtie. Really, really unique and very beautiful wine. Very unlike anything, I think, outside of it's such a drastically different climate in the valley compared to Southern Oregon or Washington or California, that what you see is an expression of Syrah that is unique. Lots of, you know, black olive and pepper, blueberry is sort of the nature of the fruit. There's lots of violets. I refer to it often as being a bit schizophrenic. You'll find iron filings, and at the same time, lots of structure from the stems, lots of elegance from the Viognier, and from the fact that it's fun to tell people that you have a Syrah that is, you know, anywhere between 12.5% alcohol and 13.8%. You know, that's the warmest vintage we've had yet. Still hasn't yielded a wine that's over 14%. So I have very high hopes, to be honest, for that grape.
How many cases do you do about that, roughly?
I think we'll be – 2010 will be 100 when we bottle that. We usually bottle it after 2 years in barrel.
It makes it special.
Yeah, it is. And it is a very unique wine and very special in that way. It's something that we find that with the restaurant scene in Portland is phenomenal. People's focus on local is absolutely lovely. There's a really a beautiful wine culture, so you get a great balance of both imported wines and also local wines. But one thing that I found that's really nice is that because the Syrah is actually grown in the valley, that there's really an immediate attraction for it within the local restaurant scene as well.
The Syrah is really interesting. I'd like to try that sometime. How many vintages have you done?
Well, we have two in barrel right now and two that have been released.
You're talking about the idea of throwback winemaking on your website when I was looking over that. And, you know, it seems like you draw from being more of a tradition-based guy, but yet you still incorporate modern ideas in what you're doing.
Well, a lot of the modern ideas, though, for me are developed out of examining older styles of winemaking. Technology is something that is, you know, it's like a double-edged sword. It makes life convenient, and then it makes life convenient. And in some ways, having the ability to have a little bit more free time to focus on the fruit is wonderful. Having, you know, a modern press is something that I'm extremely happy that we have that. But for the most part, an awful lot of the technology that's developed is about convenience and safety. And I don't necessarily think that either of those make the best wines. And I think at some point, too, some of the technological aspects give you an ability as a winemaker to insert more of your belief than is necessary. And I think the problem is that our minds tend to think in very broad strokes. And what I've seen over the time that I've been doing this is that there are non-technological ways of sort of shading things in the wine that provide to me a much more subtle and a much more honest influence. So when I look at a wine and say, you know, is how's the mid palate on this wine? I don't ever at this point think of it as, well, we need to do something in order to fill out the mid palate. What are we going to do? You know, and there's any number of things that actually can create mid palate in the wine. But the other thing you can do is you can just simply allow the wine a little bit longer time on the lees, and that lees contact will provide texture and weight and silkiness to bring balance. And it takes longer. You know, it's a very subtle stroke that requires patience rather than something that you can do. And it's obviously terrible for cash flow.
Mm.
You know, I'll be the first to say that the way that I make wine is really not intelligent in terms of running a business, other than the fact that people have to be able to taste the wines and realize that there's something unique about them. But so that's the throwback, is really pushing back to the day that people have always wanted to produce great wines. And there was a point where there weren't destemmers and where there weren't all the adjuncts and there wasn't microoxygenation and all of these things that people say, oh, this has allowed this renaissance in wine. Well, the renaissance in wine has produced an awful lot of things that taste an awful lot alike.
Mm-hmm. So, you're right. That's a really good point, and a couple of winemakers have made that point to me. The whole idea of drinking the same wine year after year after year, I mean, what would be the point of even having a vintage on it? To be just, this is the label, that's that.
Right, and why say where it's from? You know, I can't travel the world. I'm not at that financial point. But I can open a bottle of wine from somewhere, and I think when you look at the classic regions, you know, whether it's Rioja or Piedmont or Burgundy or the Loire Valley, you get a little mini trip to that place, especially if you take a little bit of time to think about the food that's going to go with the wine. It gives you an opportunity to travel without having to go somewhere. And the problem that I see with the modern technology is, you know, when Bordeaux tastes like California, then I'm not really getting a trip to France. I'm only getting a trip to California or Washington. And Washington is, you know, I can drive there anytime I want. So I definitely – that the, to me, it is – to create a unique wine, you have to leave the sense of place alone.
No, that makes a lot of sense because – and you are, after all, a world traveler because you're here in Milwaukee, for God's sake. I mean,
absolutely.
Come on. But it's true. It is about that. And we don't want to be all drinking the same thing. It would take the fun out of buying it, right? I mean,
yeah, definitely. The number one thing, I think that has to be counterbalanced with the fact that you want to put something in front of people that has quality. But it can be challenging, I think, in opening, particularly Pinot Noir, a bottle of that wine and saying, I like this right now. You know, the one thing I would challenge people to do is to look at the idea that Pinot Noir takes – you have to go to the mountain instead of the mountain coming to you with it. It's a grape that if you open it and it's not what you think it should be, chances are good that there's a better time that that bottle can be open where it will provide a better experience and possibly even maybe one of the best wine experiences you could ever have. You know, I'm the first person to say that of my top 10 red wine experiences, a large number of them have been Pinot Noir. Of my bottom 10 red wine experiences, a large number of them have been Pinot Noir.
I like that. That's a good way of putting it. As far as now, you had mentioned you're available in 10 states and here in Wisconsin. Otherwise, are you in restaurants, that kind of thing as well? Or
the wines are primarily available through restaurants. We're very fortunate. Oregon is a very, very, very strong supporter of Metella wines. We have a really wonderful restaurant scene. I think because I maybe developed out of that restaurant scene, and the wines really are meant to pair with food. We're really focused on creating things that have liveliness and energy in the mouth. And so most of the wines are consumed in Oregon. We have as I said, small amount of the wines that make it to Wisconsin and Minnesota, a small amount to Illinois as well.
Are you a chef because you've talked about your experience in the restaurant business?
No, I have to be a chef, you have to have been a cook. And to be a cook, you have to be able to deal with authority. And I never was able to do that. So I actually spent the large portion of my restaurant career as a bartender. And easily the most important thing that I did prior to becoming a winemaker in terms of giving me the ability to step in and make wine in a quality fashion right away. As a bartender, if you're creating cocktail lists and putting things together, what you're also doing is you're training your palate as to the structural necessities of a high-quality wine, whether it's sweet, sour, bitter, balance, texture, glycerin, all the things that you do when you try and combine ingredients. And because with wine, you don't get to combine ingredients. You just get the one. But the idea is to learn how to draw out all of the things that you want in a great cocktail. And so even to some extent, we certainly play with bitterness. We use a lot of stems in the ferment, and that's to try and introduce that extra complexity that you get that comes with bitters. And that's very much a distinct aspect that I never would have brought to winemaking if I hadn't been a bartender.
You know, I think you're one of the very few people I've met who has had that experience, but it makes a lot of sense because like a chef, you have to know your ingredients, and it's the exact same thing, especially these days because there's so many variations in cocktails out there and, of course, variations in spirits that you really got to know what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the diversity of the spirits too, the opportunity to work with that also is one of the reasons why, you know, we make, as I said, 2,000 cases to headed towards 3,000, but there are 15 different wines. And that's the idea that, you know, you have an opportunity to produce, you know, something that you want to drink and that's situational even. You know, for me, Oregon has four very distinct seasons. What I want to drink sitting on the patio in the summer is very different from what I'd like to drink, you know, the first weekend in December.
Marcus, if our listeners would like to learn more about you and about Metella Wines, how do they find out about you on the web?
The website is metellowines.com, W-I-N-E-S. I think if you forget to put the S on, it still directs you there. The website is definitely, you can see a work. I like to think of everything that we're doing as an evolution, and you can certainly see some of our individual nature in the site, as well as the quirks and foibles that come with, you know, building something from scratch.
You've been a great interview because you just have a really good way of spelling things out and make it easier for the listener to understand what this whole world of wine. So I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope you enjoy your visit to Milwaukee.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a fantastic place to come and visit.
Learn more about Metello and Marcus Goodfellow at metellowine.com.
Thanks for listening to this program. Watch for our next podcast featuring Charlie Meeker of the Meeker Vineyard in Sonoma. Cheers.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.